Crossroads. My name's Aaron. I'm usually down in Florence, but I'm really excited to be here with you guys today. Why don't we stand up? We're just going to start our time by worshiping God and encountering God through singing. So let's sing together.
I've been deprived of peace, forgotten true prosperity. I've chained myself to all that faith. Drank from the cup of emptiness, ate crumbs from the floor. I've filled myself with all that faith. But this I call to mind, but this I call to mind. Therefore I have hope, because of the Lord's great love. I will not be consumed. No, I will not be consumed. No, I will not be consumed. I will not. True prosperity. Oh, yeah. I've chained myself to all that faith. Drank from the cup of emptiness, ate crumbs from the floor. I've filled myself with all that faith.
Yeah.
your hands, I commit my spirit. Into your hands, I lay me down. Into your hands, I commit my spirit. Into your hands, I lay me down. You will reveal, for you will reveal. Yes, you again. We are here when your voice is like thunder, when your presence surrounds. When I can't see you and your voice is a whisper, when you're nowhere to be found. Into your
you a part of it so that you can sing along. The chorus goes like this.
And your love in wave after wave crashes over me, crashes over me. You are for us, you are not against us. Champion of heaven, you may for all to enter in.
And your love.
And your love in wave after wave. It crashes over me, crashes over me. You are for us, majesty and wonder of you, King of heaven, in humility I bow. As your love in wave after wave, it crashes over me, it crashes over me. You are for.
I just thank you for revealing yourself to us. And God, that we can experience you by you meeting us here and choosing to meet us here. So God, I just thank you for that. And God, I just ask that you would show us today what it even means to be brave. God, I know that in my life I struggle with worry and fear, and I imagine that there's a lot of people in here that struggle with the same things. But God, I really believe that you don't have those things for any of us. So God, as we listen today, God, I just ask that you would help us see your beauty and how good you are over everything else that's going on in our heads, our worries, our doubts, and our fears. And God, that we would be able to see and hear the way that you see and hear. And I just ask all of that in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, thanks for being here, everybody. I love hearing you guys sing. Why don't you find somebody around you that you don't know, introduce yourself, and then go ahead and grab your seat. Thanks for being here, everybody. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. Good to have you here today. I'm Chuck Mingo, and I'm the campus pastor here at Oakley. If you don't know, Crossroads is one church with multiple locations, and one of the exciting things is that all of our locations, including Oakley, new people are coming. And so if you're here for the first time, or maybe you've been checking this place out for a few weeks, just want to say a special welcome to you. And actually, we'd love to say hi and meet you after the service. So if you want, join us for a Connect event that's happening about 20 minutes after the service in Meeting Room C. And it's an opportunity for you to kind of make this big place small. I'll be there, and I hope you can make it. If you have kids, go pick them up in Kids Club first and then bring them with you. We've got a couple activities and treats to keep them engaged as you're meeting new people. Love to have you come and join us right after the service. One of the other exciting things happening, we're in a series called Wolfpack, and we're talking about the power of the pack, the power of community, why we all need it. And also, one of the things about a Wolfpack is when you have that many people, you can do a lot of incredible things. And so next week, we're kicking off a powerful thing this community has done 2 years now, and we're doing it for a third. Our Beans and Rice Week kicks off next weekend. In fact, I don't know if you can smell that or not, but we're about to be the stinkiest church in town, because what we do is next week, we're going to eat cheaply. Next week, starting next week, we're going to eat cheaply. We'll eat beans and rice all week long. That's the subsistence diet for many people in the world. And we'll take the difference between what it costs to feed ourselves and our families, beans and rice, and what we'd normally spend eating out, buying lunch, and even just buying other groceries. We'll take that difference and redirect those savings and give them away to great organizations outside of Crossroads doing great work in our city and around the world. And so we want you to be a part of it, because in the last 2 years, this Wolfpack, through beans and rice, has raised $870,000 together. Isn't that amazing? So if you go to crossroads.net, Beans and Rice Week, you'll find ideas for recipes and all that you need to get prepared to join us when Beans and Rice starts next weekend. Also, one other thing to let you know about, there's a staple around here, a rhythm in our community that helps people connect with God and also connect with each other and grow in an incredibly powerful way. It's the All Church Journey, and it's starting April 11th and 12th. We'd love for you to be a part of it. Love for you to be a part of it. So if you've not been a part of a journey before, this is not even just a Crossroads thing. We'll partner with 48 other churches around the city. And for 6 weeks, everybody from babies to adults will be focused on this topic. Topic we just sung about. What does it look like to take a bold new step and be brave? So we'd love for you to be a part of it. And it's three parts to the journey. One is you'll come on the weekend. You already got that part down. You know how to figure that piece out. But then you'll have some individual work outside of the weekend. And that individual work this year will be on a downloadable app that you can download on your smartphone, iPhone, or Android. You can also access it from any computer with access to the internet. And that'll be a place where you'll process a bit further what you heard on the weekend. But then the powerful thing is everybody in this Wolfpack, everybody around here, will get in a small group of 6 to 12 people. And for 6 weeks, that group will be the place where you receive encouragement and additional accountability to take a bold new step. And we need people to host groups. In fact, in Oakley, we need 2,100 hosts to host these groups. And what does that mean? It means that you'll create a space, either in your home or somewhere else, for 6 to 12 people to meet once a week and go through the group content in the app that's a part of the Brave Journey. We'd love for you to host. And so if you go to crossroads.net/journey, you'll find out more information about that. Well, God is also doing incredible things in and through this community. I don't know if you heard it or not, but we had some pretty big news this week in Clifton. Take a look at this.
In the city, you'll hear it. It's the sound of bulldozers, jackhammers, shop doors opening, people gathering. A city so full of pioneers, bold entrepreneurs, leaders, and students. It is the sound of feet running, the sound of a city that's flipping. For 20 years, we have run hard. We've gone from 11 people having church in the living room to 24,000 people gathering across 5 sites. We've opened City Lake Center, gotten knee-deep in South Africa, invested in India, resurrected old warehouses in Kentucky and Mason, redeemed an old middle school on the west side. We eat beans and rice. We give our time. We let go of personal luxuries and we pray in Jesus' name. The harder we run, the more we see Jesus offer us. Some of us have blisters and just want to catch our breath, but we have never followed a passive God. We go forth. We hear God's call to flip our city, and we follow him into the heart of it, Clifton, an anchor for urban Cincinnati, home to business owners and artists, doctors and professors, and 43,000 college students, 99% of whom aren't part of a church on campus. And 50% of these students will choose to stay and become the most powerful leaders and influencers in our city. These are the hearts and minds we need to introduce to Jesus' love and life-changing power. In the midst of this vibrant and historic community sits Old St. George, a place of ruin, a place now empty for a decade. Devastated by fire, its steeples burned, walls crumbled, tables turned. A shell of something once majestic that has the potential again to be a landmark of the city, a kingdom outpost, a feast of love. And this is where we're putting down our lives, where we are ready to invest ourselves and our money. Because we know God will bring us shoulder to shoulder with a generation and population who will change the entire future of the Queen City. Old St. George, coming in 2016. With your help, your generosity, your belief.
Come on now, come on. Jeez. Man. Yes, on Friday, we bought and closed on that property on Friday. Amazing, amazing stuff. This is really, really, really important to us, and we continue to sort of step out in faith as a community, like, oh no, where's all this coming from? How are we going to do all this? And yet, I love just your response, because we just attract a pioneering, can-do person. It's amazing here at Crossroads. We have a thing around Crossroads, a group of people who are actually responsible for enabling everything to work, because they're the regular tithers here at Crossroads. They're called the Blue Team. And I sent an email to the Blue Team announcing this and saying, hey, we need to make sure that we step up to make this happen. And I've gotten about 75 responses back from the Blue Team. All of them, hyper-positive. Let me share with you a couple of them. Pretty cool. Here's what Laurel says. I'm thrilled. The Clifton campus has been on my mind since I first heard of it. I know the focus is on college students, but the last few emails have mentioned the medical community, and that makes me very excited. I'm in. Lisa says, great vision, great leadership, great work. Count me in. It's been a good year for me. I'm so very blessed. Thankful to be able to share financially to support God's plan in our city. Doug says, we're very excited to see this happening. I personally attended that church several times during my stay at UC. William, by faith, let's go. Thanks, Brian. The T family, we are so excited and honored to be a part of what God is doing here. A lot of exclamation points. It's our pleasure to help. And I think we got one more, Brad. Let's do this. Yes. Let's do this. So we've got a special event coming up for people who are in the Blue Team to talk more about this. By the way, if you want to go to Crossroads, you can go to crossroadsosg, I think it is. I think we put the bottom thing up there. crossroadsosg.net, whatever it was, to get more information, really cool video. And if you're going, man, this Blue Team thing, I think I should be on that. I tithe. I'm newer here to the church, maybe. I haven't been known, but man, I think I should be on the Blue Team. Great. Email us at blueteam@crossroads.net, and we'd love to interact with you, see if that's the right thing for you. That would be really, really cool. Well, we're going to have the opportunity to be generous. If you're newer here today, you're going, why are people standing and clapping in church? This is weird and awesome at the same time. It is really fun to be a part of Crossroads right now. And part of what we do is we're generous. If you're newer today, hey, man, just allow us to serve you today. Feel free to let that bag pass you by. But times like this remind us, this is why we want to be engaged around here, to bless people's lives and build into people. So we'll have a bag that comes by if you want to do that. A lot of us do it electronically. You can go to crossroads.net/give. Well, while we do that, let's get ready for our next dude skill.
I'm Andy Lay, and this is Dude Skills. Dude skill number 5, trapping small game. The first thing you're going to want to do is to find a food source and a water source. Once you find those sources, you will find a run. A run is the path that the animal usually takes to get to those sources. You can set your snare in that run. The best way to make a snare is to take a piece of string. You're going to tie a knot in one end of the string. Then you're going to run the other side of the string through that knot and make a loop and you're gonna hang it ever so slightly over top of the path that the animal takes. Make sure you hide it very well with vegetation and make sure it's anchored down to a root or a tree. Bright color is not the best one to use, but I'll use it for this. Come back in a few hours and see if you have dinner. The best way to increase your odds is to set multiple snares. And there you have it, trapping small game.
That's pretty cool. I'm not sure I believe it, but that's pretty cool. I'll have to try that one. As we go forward in our series now, if you've been around the last several weeks, we've been really directive talking to men, it being primarily a man series. Last week, really directive talking to women. How great did the four female wolves do last week? Great, great stuff. I was in here last week. I was at man camp with 500 other guys. That's how I got this little thing on my thing, and I can't tell you about it because what happens at man camp stays at man camp. You know, and I don't want to ruin some of the surprise because we have 500 more dudes going to be going in a couple weeks, and we'll talk about it afterwards. Really, really amazing stuff. But as we've been talking directly to men and directly to women, at this point in our series, we're going to start to turn a corner where it's going to be less gender specific during most of the messages, because we start getting into stuff that all of us as human beings need to be about and bonded together with. A couple months ago when I was researching this topic out in Montana, where I met one of my new best friends, I was interacting with a real wolf pack and interacting with wolf experts, and I learned some stuff that was inspiring and stuff that was really bothering to me. Like, the inspiring stuff is, in a wolf pack, every wolf is expected to contribute. Every wolf is meant to make sure the values and the survival of the pack comes up. Like, everyone's got to get engaged. It's really awesome. And then the other extreme, though, is that when a wolf in a wolf pack is weak, is hurting, can't contribute, that wolf is shunned or killed by other members of the wolf pack. This reminds me that you and I, as human beings, we're uniquely created in the image of God. We have capacities and desires and the ability to love that the animal kingdom does not have. In fact, I was so bothered by that I almost changed the name of the series. Because men and women, we protect, especially men, if I talk to you for a moment, we protect. And women, we protect those who are poor, those who are hurting, those who can't care for themselves. This is what God does for us, and this is what we need to do for each other. To take us the rest of the way to talk about this, I'm going to have somebody who, believe it or not, is more qualified than me on this, and you'll find out why in just a moment. He's a very good friend of mine. He's been a longtime crossroader when he was a senior executive at P&G, and now he's a senior executive at Google, so he doesn't make it here all that often. But nonetheless, I think we're all going to be challenged, and you are going to be thankful that he's talking to us about how to be a protector. Let's welcome our own very own Kirk Perry.
Good morning, 9 o'clock. You're all feeling like it's 9 o'clock. It is so great to be home. Those of you who know my story, I've been working out on the West Coast now for about 15 months. My family moved out this past summer, and I will leave you with a thought, if you take nothing else away today, that I want you to remember, which is how blessed you are to have this place called Crossroads. Go ahead, because it's worth clapping for. That expression, you don't know what you've got until it's gone, we've lived that. This is an amazing, incredible, special place. And my family and I came back this weekend because obviously I'm here speaking, but also because we are sick and tired of 70 degrees and sunny's weather out in California. I had to throw that in, guys. Come on. Had to throw that in. As Brian said, we're going to be talking about protectors this week in the Wolfpack series. In particular, how those protectors are really charged with caring for those in poverty. And I'm going to share with you a really personal story that has impacted me my entire life and continues to impact me today about that specific thing, and we're going to unpack that in a few minutes. But I'm always struck when I read the Bible, when I step back and kind of look at the through lines of how God talks extensively about three classes of people. He talks about women, he talks about children, he talks about the poor. In the book God's Politics by Jim Wallace, he says this: "We scoured the Old and New Testaments for every single reference to poor people, to wealth and poverty, to injustice and oppression, and to what the response to all those subjects was to be for the people of God. We found several 1,000 verses in the Bible on the poor and God's response to injustice. We found it to be the second most prominent theme in the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament. The first was idolatry, and the two were often related. One of every 16 verses in the New Testament is about the poor or the subject of money, mammon, as the Gospels call it. In the first three, or synoptic Gospels, it is one of 10 verses. In the book of Luke, it is one of 7. One of my favorite passages in the New Testament, in the book of Galatians, chapter 2, verses 8 to 10, says this, "For God, who was at work in Peter as an apostle to the circumcised, or the Jews, was also at work in me," and this is the Apostle Paul speaking, "as an apostle to the Gentiles. James, Cephas, and John, those esteemed as pillars, gave me and Barnabas the right hand of fellowship when they recognized the grace given to me. They agreed that we should go to the Gentiles and they to be circumcised. All they asked was that we should continue to remember the poor, the very thing I had been eager to do all along." And we also know in the New Testament that it says that Jesus came and though he was rich, he became poor. Why so many references to the poor? It's because I think God has protected classes, women, children, and the poor. And what is it about the poor that enables us to forget about them, enables me to forget about them every day? We don't live in really socioeconomically mixed neighborhoods. We really don't. How many times do you drive by and see poor people all the time? So much so, or you look at TV commercials for World Fund or United Nations, UNICEF, and you see poor people all over the world. What is it? Because it's so big, it's so daunting. What can we possibly do as individuals to change that? And also, the poor don't have a microphone. Someone told me that very recently. I think that's very true. The poor don't have a microphone like a lot of other groups do, so we don't hear from them that often. They're too busy surviving versus having the microphone. So what does poverty look like around the world? Some pretty interesting statistics here. 1.2 billion people in the world live on $1.25 a day. $1.25 a day. 2.2 billion people live on less than $2 a day. So I want you to think about this the next time you're eating a cheese cone at Skyline or you're having a tall latte at Starbucks. You are consuming what 1/3 of the world's population makes in a single day. The United States, the country we live in that we love, the most powerful nation on earth, the wealthiest country on earth. How do we stack up versus other nations in the world? This is a chart with the percent of a population in a given country that lives below the poverty line. For us in the U.S., defined as for a family of four, $22,000. And that's relative to each of those countries. What you find is countries you'd expect us to be better than, right? You look up there, it's Haiti, it's Liberia, it's Mexico. But would you expect Sri Lanka, Azerbaijan, or Thailand, as Alan from The Hangover would say? I knew we'd have more Hangover fans in the 10 o'clock service than we had in the earlier service. So thank you for that. But seriously, look how we stack up versus countries that we should be better than. What about Cincinnati, the city we love, the city we do life in? 23.5% of the city of Cincinnati's population is defined below the federal poverty line. 23.5%. That's 71,000 people. That's double the state average, double the national average, making Cincinnati the 10th poorest city in the United States. Do we notice? Do we care, importantly? The country we live in, the world we live in, the city we love, is filled with poor people, and God's command is very clear. Very clear for us in this regard. But I can tell you one thing. There's this illusion out there in our society, in particular the United States, that people can just pull themselves up by their bootstraps and get out of poverty. It is not that easy. And you're looking at me and you're judging a book by its cover. You're like, yeah, that's easy for you to say, Mr. Google, Mr. P&G. Clearly you're not living in poverty. But what I've learned and what I know in the story I'm about to share with you is that it takes a wolf pack to pull people out of poverty. It takes a team. It takes protectors to reach into individuals and help them through the situation. And I also know there's people in here who are hurting, people that are struggling with poverty, people that are living this right now. And man, my heart is with you. I know what you're feeling, but here's my encouragement to you. There are people out there who want to protect you. Stick with it. Stick with it and find those people in your wolf pack. So here's my story. Indulge me for a few minutes as I take you through a timeline of my life, which really lays out how I have dealt with poverty, but importantly, how those protectors in my life have helped me through that. My mom and dad had three of us by the time they were 22 years old. My oldest daughter is 22, and I cannot imagine her right now having three kids. I used to joke that we ran out of money before we ran out of month. In fact, in the 70s, both my mom and dad were laid off at the same time. We went on welfare and aid to dependent children. I can tell you that is both humbling and humiliating. One of the specific things I remember that seared into my brain is we went to a place called Farmer Jack when we were living in Detroit, which is the equivalent of Kroger here. My mom had bought some groceries and pulled out her food stamps to pay for those groceries. I remember as the woman was scanning, she had this look of scorn as she grabbed this pack of Little Debbie Swiss rolls. How many of you secretly love Little Debbie Swiss rolls? How many of you? All right, I know there's some fans out there. I feel you. Let me tell you something. As a poor kid, that was a luxury. I can tell you from experience, when you are in poverty, the things we all take for granted are luxuries to people without luxuries. And I remember as that woman grabbed that pack of Little Debbie Swiss rolls, she looked at my mom and said, "You cannot buy Little Debbie Swiss rolls with food stamps. Go buy your children healthier food." And she got progressively louder, and I remember feeling this big. She was humiliating, shaming us because of our socioeconomic status. I felt shame as an 8 or a 9-year-old, and I remember looking around. I could tell you what she was wearing, what she looked like. She had those glasses with that little, you know, thing that she'd put down. I can picture her to this day, and I remember the look on people's faces as they turned around like, oh, more poor people trying to buy junk. They're not pulling themselves out. I could just feel that and sense that as a kid. I remember going to my grandma's house. We called her Gagum, and this is a picture of her and my aunt and my brother and I a few years before this story. My mom was, I think, having a gallbladder attack, but some medical situation going on, and my dad and mom drove us to my grandmother's house, and there were three of us, and we were, 5 years old, probably 3 years old, about 1.5 years old. So dropped us off, rang the doorbell. My grandmother comes to the front door, and she's smoking. She says, "Oh my God, these kids are filthy. Go around to the back." It's my grandmother. We were outside the entire time we were there. She never let us into her house. She put us down here. This is my grandmother. Made me feel like the lowest person on earth. And I didn't really sense it then, but how weird is that your own grandmother put you in that place? Imagine how other people treat you when you're in that situation, when you're in poverty. We moved to Cincinnati a couple years later, and we lived in a trailer. In a trailer park. Nothing wrong with living in a trailer or in a trailer park, but it isn't the bastion of middle class. It isn't. My mom and dad both worked afternoons, and they'd leave for work at 3 and get home at midnight. So we get home from school, 10, 7, 8-year-olds, and we were on our own until we went over and had dinner at a woman called Mrs. West's house. And I remember her, an elderly woman who took care of her grandkids, and she would feed us dinner. But after dinner, we would go home by ourselves, do our chores, get ready for bed, all the things that typically older kids do, by ourselves, and we were alone until midnight, till my parents got home. Imagine you're in a situation where you have to make this excruciating choice because we couldn't afford a night nanny, we couldn't afford to have somebody come to the house and watch us. My parents had to make this unbelievable choice between having, you know, protection for their kids and safety and making a living and just getting by. It was unbelievable. I remember, in particular, in this neighborhood, a bus would come pick us up in the trailer park, and we had some neighborhoods around us. And there was this girl I thought was the prettiest girl at the time. I was in fifth grade. This is a picture of me in fifth grade. I know I look terribly dorky. But this girl was a year older than me, and I thought at the time, because I have a much cuter girl now, I thought at the time she was really cute. I remember sitting in the seat in front of her this day. I was by myself in the seat, and she was behind me with this other girl, and I heard her say out loud, "Hey, do you think that guy in front of us, do you think he's cute? Do you think he's going to be cute when he gets older?" I was like, "Yeah, she notices me. You know, she's like..." But the other girl said something which literally pierced my soul. She said, "Oh my gosh, that guy has blonde hair and black eyebrows." I don't know if that meant anything. And then she said, "He's trailer trash. He's not going to amount to anything." I was a 10-year-old kid, and somebody was putting me in my place. You know what, though? I want to call her and say, look at me now. Brian, yesterday when I told this story, he said, you know what you should do? You should call her up, invite her to your lake house, and throw her off your boat. I'm only kidding about that, kind of. About this time when we moved to Cincinnati, living in this trailer, I made the first sports team I'd ever tried out for and made. It was a baseball team, Sertoma Club Giants, North End, Little League. So excited. I show up my first day at practice with one of those plastic baseball gloves. You know, the kind that comes from Kmart with the wiffle ball and the wiffle ball bat, because the only thing you could catch with this was a wiffle ball because it was that unsturdy. And I remember showing up for practice, and our coach was a guy named Larry Jordan. And Larry was in his mid to late 20s, newly married, didn't have a kid on the team, so there was no daddy ball. He just loved baseball, and he loved kids. Very encouraging. But after a couple of weeks of practice, he pulled me aside and said, Kirk, I love how you're playing. You got a lot of potential, but you need a real baseball glove. Go tell your mom and dad you need a baseball glove. So I went home that night and told my mom. And my mom had this like nervous tic where she'd run her fingers through her hair because money was always so tight in our house. She said, I can't afford to buy you a baseball glove. There's no way we can do that. And I was crying because I wanted this baseball glove. The kids on the team were making fun of me because I was the kid with the plastic baseball glove. Because kids do that kind of thing. And I remember I was so upset. But I came home from school the next day. What was sitting on the kitchen counter? Baseball glove. I was so excited. I remember I wrote my mom a note. My brother always teases me that I was always the note writer in the family and the brown noser. But I remember writing the note to my mom and dad, and I put it, or my mom, and I put it on top of my baseball glove. And I was woken up when my parents got home from them yelling at each other. My dad said, how can you buy a baseball glove when we barely can make it through the month? We can't even pay our rent. We can't feed the kids every day. Why in the world would we buy a baseball glove? Who cares about baseball? He can use the glove he has. Take the glove back. I cried myself to sleep that night. I remember it like it was yesterday. And I remember going to practice the next day. And I remember Mr. Jordan pulling me aside. And I struggled to get the words out of what was going on. I was embarrassed. I was embarrassed that I couldn't afford a baseball glove. But this is where this protector comes into my life. And he said, Kirk, if your mom and dad can't afford that glove, I will buy it for you. I will give you the money for that baseball glove. The 20-something-year-old baseball coach without kids reached down to this kid in poverty and gave me a way out. This is a picture of Mr. Jordan and I just a few years ago. He's been a part of my life ever since. He believed in a kid who couldn't help him, who couldn't give him anything, and he reached down to me. He passed away in January of a sudden heart attack. I gave the eulogy at his funeral. He was a protector in my life, and he built into me in ways that other people didn't do. My first protector, Mr. Jordan. We joke in our house that at dinner, we had survival of the quickest. We'd bring food in, and it would evaporate by the time it hit the table because we just didn't have that much food. But here's the other unique thing about people in poverty, and I can tell you this firsthand. Little things are treasures. When my parents would buy pop, Coke, soda, whatever you happen to call it, and Little Debbie Swiss rolls, that's going to keep coming up, guys, because that's a theme in my life. We would literally, quote unquote, steal them. We'd grab a bottle of Coke, and we'd take a Little Debbie Swiss roll, and we'd hide them in our rooms. And I remember when you finish our homework, I'd close my door and I'd pop open, like Thurston Howell III, I'd pop open that Coke and you know, eat that Little Debbie. I'd just cherish that thing like it was caviar on an expensive cracker and champagne, because that's the way people in poverty think about the little things, about the little things. When I went to high school, Richmond High School in Richmond, Indiana, a principal named Denny French. I was a sophomore just a couple months in. I remember one day walking down the hall. I played football and getting involved in other things. And he flagged me over and said, hey, I'd like to see you after school today if you have time. And 15-year-old kids think I'm in trouble or I haven't done something that I should have when the principal is asking you to come to the office. And I went there, and he said the most interesting thing. He said, tell me about yourself. Tell me about yourself. What's interesting about you? What do you have aspirations to do? And first time anybody had really ever asked me that in my life. And I didn't know. I fumbled through whatever answer I gave. I don't honestly even remember what I said. I do remember what he said, though. I've been seeing you around here. I think you have a lot of potential. I want you to be a part of my advisory council to help like other kids in other grades on issues that are affecting the school. He believed in me. He saw something in me. He encouraged me to run for class office. I did that the next year. This kid who clearly was on the lower economic rung in the school and won class president. Because that guy, Denny French, who was a protector, saw something in me, believed in me, planted a seed. I remember senior pictures that year. My mom bought me a sports coat, first sports coat I ever owned, a sweater, pants, shoes, the whole nine yards. And, you know, I don't even think about that for my two kids who are in college for their senior pictures. Bought them, didn't think about it. As I tried them on, everything fit well. My mom said, don't take the tags off. Why do you think she said that? Because she needed to take them back. It's like, I am not taking those back. Because importantly, a girl I liked was working at that store. So I said, I am not taking them back. I'm not going to be embarrassed. This is crap. You need to buy. Everybody else gets clothes in school. I have to pay for it. What are you talking? My mom said, hands through the hair. I can't afford those clothes. If you want them, you're going to have to buy them. And this is a guy whose car got gallons to the mile, not the other way around. So when I worked, my whole paycheck went into my car to pay for my car insurance and to keep my car running so I could get back and forth to work when I could. But I had a choice, and my mom had this excruciating choice that people in poverty have between what you need and what you want and what you can afford. It's a crazy thing. So a couple years off between high school and college to save money because I had to pay my way through. I was working at a Wendy's restaurant. It was an amazing experience because it taught me to be humble and to work hard. And I remember there was a guy named Rick Skirvin who was my store manager. And Rick came in to check me out at closing one night, Saturday night, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning. He was evaluating me, and we were having a conversation. He said, hey, you have a lot of potential. Why aren't you in school? I said, well, I'm saving money. I'm trying to, but you know, I don't know if I can do that and this is the only way I can make it through. And he said, tell you what, if you get in, I'll work around your school schedule, which was way harder on him. But he said, I see something in you, and you have a lot more potential than this. And he was a protector. He saw something in me, even though I did not see it in myself. I drove a truck and delivered food. I was a bartender and I was a waiter. I painted houses. In fact, in the summers when I'd work two jobs, I'd drive a truck from 5 a.m. till 4 p.m. I'd go to the restaurant I worked at. I'd stand outside and shower myself off outside and go in and change and be a waiter that night till about midnight. And that's how I had to get through. That's how I saved money. And when I went to college at UC, so I'm so psyched about Old St. George, I have to tell you, because as a student, I went there a few times, and I'm so committed to that, I'm all in on that as well. And I can tell you that I was working 60 hours a week, going to school full-time, and I was deciding that I was going to have to go to night school. I just couldn't physically do it anymore. I had a professor named Ilsa Hawkins, another protector, pulled me aside after business law class one day and said, have you thought about going to law school? And I kind of explained to her what I just said. She said, tell you what, I need you to go talk to a guy named Clyde Parrish. The assistant undergraduate dean of students. I want you to tell him your story. And if you need anything else, please let me know. She was a protector. The through line of my story is about people who reached down and pulled me up, even though there was cost to themselves or no benefit to them whatsoever. They saw something in me I didn't see in myself, but they were my protectors. They're all part of my wolf pack. So as I look back on this time, I can tell you, as I then graduated and started working at P&G, I was two things. I was hard. When I'd see somebody asking for money, I'd say, get a job. How many of you have ever done that? Don't raise your hands, but how many of you have ever done that? How many of you have had somebody ask you for something and you say, and I've said this over and over again, you put yourself in the situation, you'll have to figure a way out, because I didn't understand that I had protectors and wolf packs. So my mentality of being in poverty and thinking I pulled myself up by myself was a fallacy that I didn't understand at this point. It also caused me to be incredibly stingy because I didn't want to give my money away to anybody because I thought they're either going to misuse it or they're going to misappropriate it or something's going to happen. In my mind, I had two pictures. I had a picture of Jim and Tammy Faye Baker. Forgive me, for we have sinned. We have spent your money unwisely. And the televangelist portion. And then Billy Ray Valentine, also known as Eddie Murphy in the movie Trading Places. Can you help a brother out? Can you help a brother out? So con artists and people who would take my money and misappropriate it. That's how I pictured my giving, was through the lens of those two things. But interestingly, it was dolls that changed my perspective on this. Dolls. You guys are like, well, what's the rest of the story there? So we're living in Asia, And we went to Bali, Indonesia, and these are Balinese dolls. And we were walking down the street, and there's a series of like 10 by 10 kiosks, cinder block cement, covered with thatched roofs. And we saw these from the street, so we went in, and you can tell intricate detail, hand-carved, amazing. $25 was the asking price, $25. I remember going in, because at this time, I was hard of heart, and I was stingy. And I remember going in, and the woman in her late 20s, early 30s, negotiation to me was a sport. And much to my wife's chagrin, I started negotiating with this woman, and I won. And I got her down to $12. And I couldn't pat myself on the back enough as I reached into my stingy pocket to pull out my wallet to pay her. But as I did that, something happened. I looked down, and I saw a piece of cardboard. And on that piece of cardboard was a four-year-old girl. And as I looked around the room, I saw two bedrolls in the corner, and then I saw a little table with things on it, clearly a kitchen table. And in the other corner, I saw shelves with clothes on it. So not only was this their business, this is where they lived. And I remember it hit me at that moment. I'm like, who am I? Who am I that I'm not so far removed from who these people are? And I'm negotiating with them as a sport when they need something from me. I was not a protector in the least. So I pulled out, and you guys would be like, whoa, big spender. I pulled out $35, and I gave it to her. It was $10 over her asking price. In my mind, I said, she can use that $10 back to the $2 a day thing way more than I can. But it planted a seed in me and really changed my perspective. I learned from dolls. And over the years, I've become significantly more generous. And thanks to my wife in a lot of ways and how God has worked on my heart as I've come in a relationship with Christ, really to be a lot more generous with my time, my talent, my treasure, because of what God has planted me in the story of my life, which could have caused me to be hard. And that's an odd thing about poverty. A lot of people who make it through think they do it on their own, and I know now it had nothing to do with me and everything to do with everybody else. So there's five traits of a protector to those in poverty that, from my experience, has really shaped who I am to this day. And hopefully I'll leave you with a few thoughts here. The first one is give a hand up, not a hand out. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 10 says this, "For even when we were with you, we gave you this rule, the one who is unwilling to work shall not eat." In a lot of cases, we say, hey, get a job or do this or do that. And my wife and I had the good fortune of being very blessed. Once I started working at P&G and she was working full-time, we were the most prosperous in our family, and we were very blessed, and we had incredible resources. And so when people would come to us and ask for money, it invariably broke down into a heated argument. My wife, who's 100% grace, the heart of Jesus, would always say, who cares why they're there, what? They have a need, and we can fulfill it. Why wouldn't we just give it to them? No question asked. I was 100% truth. No way. They didn't earn it. Da-da-da. But I always ended up doing what she wanted to do. And happy wife, happy life. And the ladies are cheering. Yeah. But I didn't give it with a godly heart. I gave it because my wife wanted me to. But what we learned to do was to think about it as a hand up. And when the hand up means if somebody needs food or medicine or transportation or housing, basics of life, we were going to help. So what that looked like is if somebody said, hey, I need to borrow money for a car, I'd say, cool, I'll help you with a car, but it's going to be a dollar-for-dollar match. You save money, I'll match whatever you have, you'll get a better car that way. Or one of my family members said, hey, I'm running out of food, can you help? I said, sure, I'm not going to give you money, but I'll go to the store with you and load you up on everything you need. So we learned to be really specific and give a hand up. CityLink is a great example at Crossroads of a hand up. The most amazing thing that we have done, in my opinion, in this church in the last few years. And what I love about this organization and why I'm still part of it, even though I live in California, I'm on the board. I do 4 a.m. conference calls when we have board calls because I feel so much a part of that organization in the hope that we can help people like so many people help me. It's a one-stop shop to help those who are working poor pull themselves out of poverty. It's a place where people can get the two most important things that we know pull people out of poverty, education and resources and networks. And that's what CityLink does. And that's the opportunity we have to change people's lives. And I can tell you that it's because of this church, because of you sitting in these seats, that CityLink is still there. And we can do even more to help people. The stories are incredible when you hear how lives are changed through what we're doing for the working poor in the city of Cincinnati. Yeah, clap for that. That's a good thing. Praise God. And it's, in fact, why my family still gives to Crossroads, even though we've been gone, because we believe in the power of what this place is doing for poverty, not only here, but around the world. Second trait is protectors lean in and take a risk with their time, their talent, and their treasure. You might get ripped off, you might get heartbroken, but you know what? It's part of the risk of being a protector. In fact, in his book, What's So Amazing About Grace, Philip Yancey says this: the Christian knows to serve the weak, not because they deserve it, but because God extended his love to us when we deserved the opposite. Christ came down from heaven, and whenever his disciples entertained dreams of prestige and power, he reminded them that the greatest is the one who serves. The ladder of power reaches up. The ladder of grace reaches down. What a beautiful metaphor. And let's look at somebody who really lives that.
Here at the Ohio Air National Guard Base near Toledo, Lieutenant Colonel Frank Daly still can't believe the honor recently bestowed upon him.
It's incredible being recognized in such a manner.
It happened at a Cracker Barrel, of all places. As the security camera shows, Lieutenant Colonel Daly entered the restaurant on February 7th for an early lunch. At about the same time, 8-year-old Miles Eckert came in with his family. Miles, in the green hoodie, was very excited. He just found a $20 bill in the parking lot.
Just sitting there?
Yeah.
Did you start thinking of what you could spend it on?
I kind of wanted to get a video game, but then I decided not to.
He changed his mind when he saw that guy in uniform.
Because he was a soldier, and soldiers remind me of my dad.
And so, with his dad in mind, Miles wrapped the 20 in a note that read, "Dear soldier, my dad was a soldier. He's in heaven now. I found this $20 in the parking lot when we got here. We like to pay it forward in my family. It's your lucky day. Thank you for your service." Signed, Miles Eckert, a Gold Star kid. After lunch that day, Miles asked his mom, Tiffany, to make one more stop.
He wanted to go see his dad, and he wanted to go by himself that day.
She took this picture from the car. Follow the footsteps, and you'll see Miles standing there behind the flag, presumably telling his dad all about it. And whether heaven heard him or not, his good deed continues to impress here on earth.
I look at it every day.
Kid gave you a bigger gift than $20.
A lifetime direction, for sure.
Lieutenant Colonel Daly says he's already given away the 20 and plans to do much more. He also hopes that little green post-it will inspire other people across the country to give as sincerely and dutifully as this father and son.
Wow. Here's the thing. That boy is a man. He's a man. He leaned in. He took a risk. He could have put it someplace else. But think about the change that that man is inspiring. The third trait of a protector is they get dirty. They get dirty. A good friend of mine, Chris Hyatt, is a Crossroads attendee. He actually lives in Geneva, Switzerland right now. But Chris has an amazing heart of servitude. He's an incredible leader, and he's also a passionate runner. And he and another fellow attendee at Crossroads, Dave Pinson, had a vision. Chris is on your left, Dave's on your right, that they were going to help men and women in need, specifically through two programs at the City Gospel Mission, the Exodus program for men and the Courage to Change program for women. These were people who were addicted to drugs, to alcohol, to other things. And they were going to show them that prayer, planning, persistence, and partnership lead to change. And they went to City Gospel Mission with this vision to train those folks in those programs how to run, and particularly to be a part of the Flying Pig. And Chuck's talked many times about how tough that is. When they went to City Gospel Mission, they said, hey, we love it when people want to help. We absolutely want you to help. But these people need way more than running and walking to change and to get where they need to be. But they persisted on. They raised money. They got clothing. They got running gear. This is a picture of their first practice back in 2009. 20 were in the Wolf Pack, people who were training and people who were trainers. This is one example, the next picture, of a woman who won Athlete of the Week. Look at the absolute joy on her face and the humility in Chris's face as he was giving her this award. Woman in addiction was affirmed. Chris reached down with a ladder of grace. But this is the most amazing picture of all. 2012, look at that Wolf Pack. Look at that Wolf Pack. Chris and Dave reached down in grace to now over 200 people participating. They have raised over $250,000 for City Gospel Mission and have transformed lives and have changed things for the better for those folks. The fourth trait of a protector is they act in humility, not in superiority. I can tell you, I had so many well-intentioned people in my life who put me on the ground. They gave me things, told me how to do things, said, you're not good enough for this, but let me tell you how to do it. Made me feel about this tall. And what I needed was somebody to humble themselves where I felt like they were beside me and behind me and pushing me along and partnering with me versus telling me why everything I had done is wrong. Unlike those protectors in my life that helped me, they were very well-intentioned. And it reminded me of the best and most amazing picture I've ever seen here at Crossroads, and a picture of a woman in Mamelodi, South Africa. Great partnership. We built a hospice. We sent them things at Thanksgiving, and we had all the go trips. It was an amazing transformational experience for many people. And they said to us, you've given us a, what can we do for you? We said, you're rich in spirit. We'd love to have you. We'd love to have you pray for us. So we took Polaroids out here. We wrote our prayer requests on, sent them over there. And look at that woman, how fervently she is praying for us because she is spiritually rich. She may be poor, but she is spiritually rich, and she gave us something back because we humbled ourselves and asked for something from those folks. I can tell you, I've had, a lot of you know my story. My oldest daughter is a cancer survivor. It was a pivotal point in my journey and my walk with Christ and opened up so many other things in my life. And I had something happen a few weeks ago that I've shared this week, and I haven't shared it publicly at all, but I got that call you always fear getting, and that call was from a doctor who told me that I have cancer. Took my breath away. I was mad at God. I was angry. I went through my stages of grief. I'm like, how can this happen to two people in our family? I'm not ready for this. I've got a lot of things going on in my life. We just moved to California. Like, all these thoughts are racing through my mind. But then I stepped back and said, gosh, you know, praise God. I've got something that is operable and treatable. I have great chance of survival. It might be a bump in the road. Thank you. Might be a bump in the road, but I really want to honor God through this. I want to show people that even when you're struggling with things, because we're all poor in poverty in some way. I'm in poverty right now in my health. Whether you're in poverty in your marriage, in poverty at work, whatever you're in poverty in, we're all there. But in humility, I wanted to send a note to my organization, a video actually, and many people recommended against it because I wanted to let them know what was going on. I wanted to let them know that I was going to go through this because I'm the protector of their organization, and they want to know that I'm going to be coming back or why am I gone. So I sent a video out, and I explained to him what was happening. I asked him for two things. One is to keep driving the business because that's really important. But two is pray for me. Pray for me. The response has been amazing. Hundreds of notes back. People sharing things with me they probably would have never shared before had I not, in humbleness, sent them what I was going through personally. And they appreciated that the leader, the protector, was walking alongside of them and sharing a struggle that I was having. And I think protectors do that. They humble themselves. They're not in a position of superiority. And the last trait is, as we think about these 5 points, is being like Jesus to those in poverty. And it's a really simple thing. Practice it like anything else, and you'll get better at it. And I want to finish a story that I started earlier, which is at UC. Ilsa Hawkins had sent me to Clyde Parish, and I went into his office this day to make an appointment, and the secretary said, it'll be 6 weeks before he can see you. And my poverty mentality said, see, I'm not important enough to get things moved around in the schedule, and I started to turn around to leave. And he was walking in and overheard the conversation, the last part of it, and said, hey, I got some free time now. Do you have a minute? I said, yeah. And he said, tell me why Ilsa sent you here and your story. And I went through and told him, working full-time, going to school full-time. I got great grades, but I'm going to have to go to night school. Told him the whole thing. He just listened for 10 minutes, didn't say a whole lot. He said, do you have a minute? I'll be right back. He was gone 10 minutes, and again, I thought, he's forgotten about me. So I started to get up to leave. There's a theme there in the poverty mentality. And he came back in with a piece of paper. And he said, I was so moved by your story. I'm going to give you, on the spot, a full-ride academic scholarship, annually renewable, and one ask is that you use your leadership skills to make this place a better place than when you got here. That's all he asked. So I signed on the dotted line. Thank you. But here's the cool part of the story. Many years later, when I took him to lunch, and my best friend in the world and I took him to lunch because we were both involved with him, and I asked him why he did it. He said two things. I saw a hunger in your eyes, and I knew you'd do something with it, And he said, I equally saw a level of desperation in your eyes, and I wanted to help you. And he also explained the behind the scenes that he got a lot of flack for that, because typically scholarships, you have to fill out a lot of things. They go to a committee, you know how universities work, and it was going to take time. But he said, I didn't want to risk that that desperation was going to drive you to do something that you would take you off track. He was a protector. He changed the entire trajectory of my life, my family's life. My ability to bless people was a direct result of that experience and that office when a protector saw potential. So the through line of all these points is that we have people in our lives who are protectors. And I'm going to leave you with three quick challenges. Two challenges and a thought, encouragement. One is, we're all, many of us in this room are elites. We have the resources well above the national average to change things for people in poverty. God's protected classes, women, children, and the poor. We have a chance to change them. And my story is probably very similar to most. Yeah, there are people that milk the system. There are people that take things they shouldn't take. But for the most part, nobody wants to be poor. Nobody wants to be poor. Everybody wants little Debbies. All right? So, second point is, I just want to encourage people. I want to encourage people who are struggling right now. I want to encourage people that are in poverty, that don't feel like there's a way out. There is a way out, and it's called Wolfpack, and it's called Protectors. Find those people. I'm with you guys. I pray every day for people who want to get out. They find those people, like I did, that would help them get out. And the last thing I'd say as a challenge is treat those in poverty like Jesus did. He dined among the poor. He gave his heart to the poor, and he never looked down on them. And it's so important when you're in poverty that people don't do that, that they treat you like an equal. You never know. You never know that that person you may treat that way may become the next CMO at Wendy's. They may become the president of P&G or Google or Fifth Third Bank or you name your institution. But because of your act, you may change the trajectory of somebody's life. God bless you guys.
Great, great, so good. No, I know a lot of us were just still processing, wait a minute, you have cancer, you're up here talking, I'm having a hard time getting over that, and I know that our heart goes for you, Kirk, because you're impacting a lot of people, including everyone across here this weekend. So I think a lot of us would just love to be able to pray with you right now. A lot of us would be able to put our hand on you and pray for you. Not all of us can do it, but I can. And if you want, if you're saying, yeah, I would love to do that, I want to be physically present, just take your hand and just kind of push it forward as a sign for you to be physically engaged if you want right now. Let's just pray for Kirk. God, I thank you that Kirk has the faith and the strength to have a godly attitude going forward in this cancer, but I know that he's human and he is weak and he is poor like all of us, and this weighs on him. And God, I'm asking you to alleviate this and you lift this from him. And you do that because you say in the Bible that you are a healer. So we're trusting on you to be a healer, and we're praying that you come across all those glands, make them operate properly, flush out what shouldn't be in there, have every amino acid that should be in its place be in its place, everything that shouldn't be there be gone. God, you do this still today, and we're asking this, you do this in our friend and our brother, Kirk Perry. And if this isn't going to happen miraculously spiritually, we're praying medically, that doc who he is blessed to be able to have with good insurance would have like a superhuman capacity to move his fingers the right way and to anticipate things while his skin is peeled back. We pray for full and complete healing for our friend Kirk. And I pray these things in your name, Jesus. Amen. All right, hey, have a phenomenal week. Get ready. Next week we'll talk about beans and rice and do some protection. Get out of here. Chop, chop.